Life's a Mitch.
G'day, ladies and gentlemen. My next guest is a dedicated professional in the field of alternate dispute resolution, specializing in family mediation and restorative justice practices. In her role as a family practitioner, she has guided numerous families through separation with a focus on respect and the well-being of children. She actively contributes to various restorative justice panels for government agencies, with a commitment of trauma-informed and strength-based approach to navigate changes and challenges. Beyond her practice, she extends her impact as a facilitator, sharing valuable insights with mediators and mental health practitioners, and promoting a strength-based lens in their work. Her passions for child development, trauma, and neuroscience fuels her continued professional development. This interest has uniquely positioned her to observe, learn, reflect, and share insights. Her academic achievements include a robust record in undergrad and postgraduate studies, encompassing law, couples, and family therapy, and family dispute resolution. Her journey into mediation began during her undergraduate studies and led her to pursue advanced studies at Harvard University in mediation and negotiation. She is also a published author and does workshops in aiding countless people, this and much more, which we'll find out today in this episode. She hasn't heard this yet, but I hope she's well. This is recorded after the initial interview. I'd like to introduce Rosemary Gattuso, and I hope you guys enjoy this chat. G'day, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Life's a Mitch. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rosemary Gattuso. How are you today?
Yeah, good, Mitch. How are you going?
Good, thank you. Whereabouts in the world do we find you at the moment?
I'm in Sydney.
Sydney? And how is Easter? Nice and busy, I'd imagine.
Yeah, lots of chocolate nonstop, but really lovely, you know.
That's good. Yeah, I got out to Dubbo. I live in Orange, and I got out to Dubbo to see my uncle and auntie, and went to some drag races, ate some chocolate, saw some friends, and just become an absolute blimp. It feels like it was so good. I put on so much weight, but I don't care.
It's worth it, isn't it?
Absolutely. So in that introduction that you haven't heard yet, and the fans will be like, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to talk about, you know, your career, talk about how you got into the mediation space practicing the restorative justice, and talk about how you got onto that career path and everything in between, how you got started and what you're up to today. But first, I'm just wondering if you'd like to join me in having a quick bitchy with Mitchy.
Of course. Sounds good.
So the premise is, it's a lighthearted whinge about anything that's ailing you, or if it's a serious matter, you're more than welcome to bring it to light. And I always give the option of the guest if you'd like to go first, or I can. It's up to you.
No, I'm happy to go first.
No, by all means, take it away.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I'm want to bitch about but also have a connection with is social media. And because sometimes I love it, and then sometimes I hate it. And I guess the part of it that can annoy me is, you know, those kind of mental health influences that are really, I guess, making personal benefit from people's adversity and vulnerability. They're not all like that, but I know that there are some, because there's a lot of opportunity in it. And that's, I guess, because I can sort of come under that umbrella in the work that I do. So sometimes it can really annoy me. But at the same time, I've had some really good connections, unexpected. So I want to bitch about it, but there's a proviso there, if that makes sense.
So you're saying for every negative, there's a positive kind of thing?
Yeah.
So like,
we can't just blanket and say every influencer on social media who's a coach or in mental health is no good, because they can be quite helpful.
Yeah.
And you know, provide, interesting connections and links and, you know, plant the seeds for people to then go on their own journey.
Yep.
But there's also some, I know it's a bit serious, but it's just really irking me.
So
in those apps, and I see and I think, oh,
that's fine. Like a serious topic is a nice change of pace. So are you saying Like, say if you come across someone on social media and you see them trolling someone, getting stuck into them, so like bullying them online, a keyboard warrior,
Well, that,
say.
yeah, I guess that's also part of it, but
Yeah.
also, you know, those influencers who are offering the world to help people, you know, clear their blockages and heal them of their childhood trauma, because they've also healed themselves of their childhood trauma. And I mean, not that the lived experience is important, but sometimes, you know, it's not, you need a little bit more to be able to help people. So that's, you know, that's what can piss me off a bit. You know, and
Yes.
because I'm in that field, I have a very particular lens that I view mental health with as well. So it could also be part of my learning is to hold back my own judgment. So that's also part of it. Maybe that's really what pisses me off, my own judgment.
Oh, we can delve into that in a little while. And you're right though, like if you can, I know as a consumer, find someone that you resonate with. And if you don't get out what you think you're putting in, then yeah, I can see where you're coming from. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, because
Yeah.
it's almost like that commercial mental health. That's what I see, or even the commercial spiritualism that can also come under that umbrella with, you know, healers and people who come and say, oh, you know, I can help you resolve your childhood trauma.
Yeah, no, fair call. That's an interesting point. And I guess I can, my pitch is, I can sort of tag onto the back of that and talk about one of the negative like connotations of social media. It's that what irks me is that you get, no matter where you go, whether it's a fan page of a football club or a buy, swap, sell page of your local area, there's always someone there who's trolling. And it's,
Yeah.
you sort of just go, are you for real? Like there was a lady, a lovely old lady on my local page, and she was just trying to like do a shout out to the person who thanked her at the local fish and chip shop, I think it was. And people hopped on there and go, oh, you don't need fish and chips. Look at the size of you in your photo. And just, it just kept
Oh.
going from there. And it's, you just think like, why people
Your
bother? Like, you,
yeah.
and yet, like, this lady genuinely wanted to shout out to the young person who helped her. Or, and then just, yeah, the hatred. Like, I don't get it. I just, why make someone's journey harder than it needs to be? I don't understand. And anyways, so that really pisses me off. Like, yeah, I've copped it a few times, you know, doing this, and you know, you got to keep going with it. But to those people who are, you know, struggling in that realm of mental illness or, you know, feeling vulnerable on that day, and to cop an attack like that, that's, yeah, that's my bitch. I think it's a bit unfair.
Yeah, can be quite heavy because you don't know, you know, the person who's making those comments doesn't actually know anything about that individual or what they're going through or where they've been or their motivation. So, yeah, I guess that's, you know, the other side of social media is that it's given everyone the opportunity to just say whatever, you know, comes in their head, which in a face-to-face setting, they would never say.
Yeah,
That
and
it's not really socially acceptable to respond to someone like that.
yeah.
But if it's, you know, on social media where no one sees who you are, then you can. And you
Keyboard
can have
warriors.
confidence behind the screen.
Some of the toughest people I've ever come across have been behind a screen in front of a keyboard.
Yeah.
Ironic that, eh? But no,
Yeah.
you raise an interesting point, and thank you for bringing it up. It's something that people should be aware of, obviously, and that's why I like to come here and talk about stuff. And even if I can have awesome guests on like yourself and entertain people and take them away from their busy lifestyle for 45 to an hour, then my job's done. And yeah, and the rest is, it just becomes easy. So thank you for raising that, and I feel good. Like, it's a good icebreaking tour. It allows me to sort of settle in and sort of relax and get focused, and we dive in.
Oh,
So
good.
here's a question without notice. I'm sorry, I to the listener,
Fine. Yeah.
I sent a list of questions to Rosemary, just a, you know, a broad outline of questions. As we know, it's a pretty like off the cuff sort of conversational type pod. But I love asking this question, and I put it to Nicole yesterday.
Yeah.
Take yourself back to the earliest version of yourself you can remember. Do you remember the first ever thing that you were a fan of, whether it was a show, like a toy you had, or a book or something like that? What was your first ever fandom?
I would have to say cooking. I know it sounds not, you know, a very obvious thing to be a fan of, but yeah, I, for as long as I can remember, I have always been interested in cooking and watching other people cook and then learning and doing classes and just, yeah, always, you know, even when I travel, it's about food and where I can even, you know, go to learn about the local food. So again, it's sort of linking in with the Easter weekend theme of food and eating. But yeah, that would be a big thing. And I think also because culturally, you know, my parents are Italian, so it was always a big part of life was food.
Yeah, fair enough. And I actually had Italian food last night near a Italian restaurant opened up here in Orange, and it was molto bene.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's good.
So, okay, well, I was going to ask what influences you had, but you're talking about your parents. Is there like a go-to dish that you're a real big fan of making? Like if you could claim a dish as your own, what's yours?
I don't know if I have a dish of my own, but I tend to really stick to very familiar ingredients or familiar combinations of ingredients. So, yeah, like, and you know, of course, it's linked to my heritage. So anything with eggplant, you know, that's very, very typical of, you know, where my family's from, and a lot of, say, mixing pork with peas and mushrooms. So if that's in the fridge, you'll get maybe five or six variations of those ingredients. But and it's also originated from, you know, they call it in Italian, it's called cucina povera, and it's like the poor kitchen, because it's you just whatever you had, whatever's in season, putting things together, and you have the most cheaper sort of ingredients would make the bulk of the proportions, and then more the luxury, like the meat or something, would be a smaller proportion in that dish. So, but it's just putting together whatever you have.
It's what, 9:44 in the morning, and I am hungry as. That sounds great.
Oh gosh.
Oh, no, that's
brunch
awesome.
When we finish, yeah.
Definitely. So, okay. That was a bit of an extra long ice breaking tour, but I like that. That's good. Like, I like to obviously hear about the person's career who's on and a little bit about themselves, and yeah, like it's all good fun. This podcast is great. Like, we've had an eclectic range of guests so far, and
I noticed you've got such a big mix of guests, which is really awesome.
Yeah, and thank you for that, and thank you for reaching out. And so we'll talk about you. I sound like you have an interesting story, and we'll get there. But I guess the first question I wanted to ask you was, what was the genesis of your career, and how did you get started in the space of helping families and ultimately leading you to the journey as to what you do now? Can you explain like how you got started, and sort of we'll talk, and then we'll get into your current role, if that's all right, please. That makes sense. Yeah,
that's fine. I guess how I got started is really by pursuing what I thought I wanted to do and realizing that it really wasn't for me. But I being exposed to alternative dispute resolution and mediation. And essentially what that means is that I did undergraduate and postgraduate law degrees, thinking that, you know, I wanted to be a lawyer, I wanted to be a solicitor, I wanted to work in, I knew I always had this thing about working with families. So I wanted to work in family law. And I guess by pursuing that, it was quite obvious, even within a first few years of study, that it wasn't really for me, and it didn't really highlight my strengths. It really highlighted my weaknesses. So, but I didn't really know what else to do. So I just continued and finished. And it wasn't really until, the last semester of my studies where there was a practical component and mediation, or what I guess it was under the umbrella of alternative dispute resolution. That was a compulsory component, and most people in my class really hated it. And I really loved it, and I thought, oh, this is what I want to do. So that's really how I pursued. I mean, I had to finish that, or you know, those legal studies first, and then I guess be exposed, because I didn't know what mediation was before then, because I mean, at that time it was, you know, nearly 20 years ago, the traditional legal system was really considered or even promoted as the way to resolve disputes. So that was, dispute resolution was going to court. So this alternative really gelled with me, and it really highlighted my strengths rather than my weaknesses. So then I became really drawn to that that field, and really wanted to do, or tried to do, I guess, whatever I could to become a family mediator. At the time, it was really just retired judges and barristers who were in that role. So it was quite challenging, because I was kind of no one. You know, it was something, work that you got by reputation. And then in about 2006, there were changes to the family law and the process there, which essentially set up this role as a family mediator called a family dispute resolution, you know, dispute resolution practitioner. And that was registered with the Attorney General's Department and part of the family court system. So I thought, wow, okay, this is my, you know, my opening. And I did the studies for that. I mean, I'd already studied mediation at Harvard and did a placement in Boston. So I already knew what I was doing, but I just needed that opportunity. So I had to do the relevant course and the placement. And that was really how I was able to get into family dispute resolution or family mediation.
Yeah. Wow. So the study's taken all over the world, and you sort of had to create a name for yourself in a rather specified field of law, it sounds like.
Yes, and that's essentially why I went to Harvard, because all the real sort of thought provokers of mediation and the sort of leaders in that industry came from Harvard. So, and they were offering a negotiation and mediation program. So I thought, I'll do my studies there. Then when I'll come back, that will give me credibility. But it, even that wasn't really enough, because it was just such a small field, and people weren't used to going to mediation. They were still used to going to their solicitor or going through the court process. So it was really only after those changes, legislative changes took place that created this job, this role that I was after, that it made it smoother for me to get in there. And I was quite young in comparison to everyone else as well. So I guess there was always that, and maybe that was more about my insecurity, thinking people are going to look at me and say, you're so young, how do you know what to do, or how would you know about divorce and things like that. So yeah, but that could have just been my own insecurity.
I think we all suffer from a bit of tall poppy syndrome from time to time. Or is it imposter syndrome, where you're in a room and you find, I think it's imposter syndrome.
Yes.
When you, actually, a friend of mine does an imposter syndrome podcast. Can't believe she's going to shoot me for forgetting that. But not really, just figuratively. Okay. So you're Harvard. You've attended Harvard. I think you're the first guest I've had on who's attended Harvard. So that's awesome.
Well, we only have coincidentally, Mark Zuckerberg was there at the same time, and around the corner from me, and he was setting up Facebook, but I had no idea. I was like seriously watching the Cooking Channel because I had cable, and I'd never had cable before, you know, or pay TV. Yeah. And, you know, watching Friends, which was still, that's going to show how long ago it was, watching the last episode of Friends and taping it on VHS for my neighbor.
Oh, I remember those, like back to those days as well. Like VHS was, and I got in trouble because I think I taped over one of my brother's soccer grand finals for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I don't regret anything. And he said later on in life, he's like, I don't care, we lost that one. The turtles are great. So, well, okay. So you've had to study internationally and it set you up on this career path. You spoke about the legislative changes that helped set up mediation. Were there any obstacles that you had to face during your studies, or was it pretty much you graduated, you're able to come back and sort of set yourself up in the realm? Well, what are some of the obstacles you had to overcome to set yourself up?
Probably the biggest obstacle was me, you know, because I had a lens that my view of myself wasn't great. So when you don't see yourself in the best light, it's hard to put yourself forward. So I think that was also part of my stumbling block, because perhaps if I was more confident generally at that time, my career might have progressed a lot quicker. Because if you are, say, if you're in a job interview and you deep down don't believe that you're good enough for that role, then that's going to seep into everything that you do and say and show, even your body language in that interview. And it's going to make it harder, because if you don't believe in yourself, how can they? Why would they hire you? So I realized that I had that view of myself up until I actually got my first job as a mediator in a family relationship center here in Sydney. And it was really in that role that I had both personal development and professional development, because it was the first time I was in a role in a position where, you know, the people around me really highlighted my strengths and really supported my strengths. And you know, the manager was running a strengths-based team. You know, she was using that strengths-based approach. So every time I, you know, did something that worked really well, it would be applauded, it would be encouraged, it would be supported. If I, you know, worked well with a particular sort of, you know, type of client, or if someone walked into the center, they might be referred to me because my personality suited, you know, their needs and their situation. So it was really being shown sort of, you know, what I'm good at and what my strengths are, that I started to believe it myself. And that's really, I would say that was a massive turning point for me, and where I could see that I was really my biggest obstacle.
Yeah, fair enough. And we'll talk about it later, but you've written a book about overthinking and sort of, I think we're all I tend to overthink a lot of things, but as you said, overcoming yourself, which we'll talk about that shortly. But I wanted to sort of ask you, where did the passion for wanting to aid others come from? Like in the development, the trauma, and the neuroscience of helping children, where did sort of the passion to want to help everyone sort of come from? So I hope I questioned that right.
Yeah, that's fine. I think, well, it's interesting because from as long as I remember, I always wanted to work with families. So even when I had this, you know, I thought that I was going to be a family lawyer or a family solicitor. It was always in that sort of community and you know, helping others. So, and I think that's also part of my personality as well. You know, I tend to be, you know, the one that I guess people can talk to and turn to for advice or support on things. And even, from a young age. And, you know, there are, you know, people now who are in their 70s who will say to me, oh, I remember when you were 14 and you helped me. And I thought, oh, and like, it's not something that I was really aware of or would say, oh, that, you know, that's what I do. But now on reflection, I can see that in many areas of my life, that's sort of been my role, or the role that I have taken or comes easy or natural for me. And so then, and then I guess what happened is the more I worked with families, then the more that I saw, I became interested in human behavior and why people respond in a certain way and why others respond differently, because I would, you know, have families with very similar situations and similar challenges or hurdles to overcome, but the outcomes could be extremely different. And it really was a reflection of the lens that family chose to view their situation. And so I think I've gone off the question.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Always feel free to speak your truth. This is your story and I definitely want to hear it. And I know others would like to hear it as well. So just so like I understand a bit, can you just sort of give an example of a scenario that might play out, like purely hypothetical? Like how would could you just talk to us about how someone would approach you, some of the challenges you might have to face with them? Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine. And I think for me, my observations were more about the trends that were happening rather than the facts. I mean, because the facts could be anything and they could be the same or they could be different. But it was really about the approach of the individuals. And what I noticed is that, you know, being in a situation where you've got, you know, a family going through separation and all the changes and the challenges and decisions that need to be made about finances, about children, about schooling. Oh, there's a whole range of things that impact and change the lifestyle. The difference between how quickly those hurdles were overcome and how successful the transition was could be dependent on the lens that those individuals took. And what I noticed was that there were two options. So one option was to view the situation through the lens of what's wrong, the weaknesses, and you know, what's not working. And the other lens was the what's strong lens that looked at the strengths and also, you know, took out the lessons and the, you know, learning opportunities from, you know, past situations, and also had a future focus, whereas the what's wrong lens tend to have a focus in the past. So, you know, what happened, what shouldn't have happened, and what was done to me. So I guess that's really how I've been able to differentiate the ways that people manage adversity.
Yeah, fair enough. That sounds like a very challenging role, but it also sounds like it's, you know, you need to show a lot of empathy, a lot of compassion, and to give a genuine care about the people who come and see you. I think I speak from anyone, we say we're lucky to have you. But not a lot of professionals come across like that. So kudos to you, I think.
Thank you. And I think it also reflects back on the curiosity and the interest that I had in child development and trauma generally and neuroscience, because and I guess that's what I was getting at before, that you know, observing people in, you know, some of their worst, you know, or most challenging times of their lives, then it got me to look at, well, what's the meaning behind the way that we respond to the outside world? And that's where I looked at child development and also trauma generally. And I guess I started to see that our thoughts, feelings, or actions, or anything that comes under our behavior is really just a reflection of the quality of our early experience. So then, and then that would lead me to then, instead of looking at someone and saying, oh, they've got odd behavior, or they're sort of got some sort of quirks, or, but it's more of a negative sort of connotation, or even diagnosis to a certain extent. And rather than using that terminology, it's about saying, well, this is a clue to their early experience. because we are adaptations of our experience, that their experience has taught them that they have to respond to external stimulus or whatever's happening outside in that particular way. So when you have that sort of child development and trauma lens, it also makes it easier to have more compassion, you know, or show empathy in those situations.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a necessity. I mean, if you genuinely want to help people, then there's definitely good traits to have.
And I think also because mediation by definition is where you have a third party neutral who helps guide the you know, conversations. And one of the first things that I do say to clients is that, you know, my role is not to take sides or to judge or to give an opinion. And that's quite an important part of being a mediator, and really the difference between, you know, being in front of a mediator and being in front of a judge or a magistrate, because a judge or a magistrate will take sides. They will make a decision. So, and this sort of idea of non-judgment then really helped me to sit back. And I mean, I'm only human, so, you know, it's almost impossible to be non-judgmental the whole time. But in my role, it's for me to, I guess, reflect on when I find myself in, you know, being judgmental, because it's their lives, it's their situation. You know, unless there are safety concerns, then it's up to them how they run their household. And also that issue of judgment is that if a client does feel judged, then, well, they're going to make a complaint about me, or it's going to make them hard to actually work with me. And even though they own their outcomes and their agreements, because I just help them get it on paper. But it's up to them. But, you know, if you think back to a time you had a conversation with someone where you felt judged, you know, it's not easy to then be honest or to be yourself in front of that individual. So that having that as a sort of part of being what it means to be a mediator has also helped and helped me be less judgmental, because then I feel myself thinking, oh my goodness. And then it's like, oh, okay, it's none of my business, you know.
Yeah, 100%. Just for those like myself who might have a little understanding, but in your own words, can you just describe what mediation is? Just from a profession, like your professional opinion, because just yep. So I understand it properly.
Yeah. And yeah, thanks for that, because it's not a service that a lot of people have experience with. And most people have experience with the legal system or, you know, other systems. So, yeah, it's a good – thanks for asking me that. So my role is to sit with people in conflict. And, you know, at the moment it's mainly, you know, families going through separation, and to really help facilitate the conversations that they have with each other. So, you know, my role is not to take sides or make a judgment or even give advice. It's really just to set up a safe place or in a comfortable place for two people who maybe haven't been in the same room together for longer than, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, to sit down together for 3 hours and really talk about, you know, the most valuable parts of their lives, you know, and talk about their children, and be able to work together. And sometimes it's not necessarily in the same room. Sometimes it's virtual. Sometimes it's in separate rooms. And it's really just about, and it's really guided by, you know, the clients, what are the pressing topics for them, because they get their opportunity to really share what they want to use the time to discuss, and then go through, you know, whatever is important to them. So I'm there, I guess. I mean, some people say it's sort of like a referee, but a referee does does make more more judgments and calls than a mediator does. But it's kind of a similar way to explain, you know, just guiding the conversation, because sometimes, you know, if you're with someone speaking to someone about something really important and you really don't like each other, you don't want to be with each other anymore, but you have to work together. Sometimes that face-to-face can just escalate and go off topic. So my role is also to help bring the discussion and the focus back on what's important, what should be prioritized as well. I mean, ultimately it's up to them, but I can give them a reminder that, you know, of what their priorities are for the day. So does that make sense?
Yeah. So basically people that want to avoid heavy court fees would come to you, try to mitigate the cost, try and work it out in a civil manner, as opposed to arguing hammer and tong in court and trying to get a resolution sooner rather than later.
Actually, yeah, that's a great point, because mediation is not evidence-based, whereas the court process is, where you have to bring forward to say, this is what, you know, he or she did wrong and why this should happen this way, and this is the law that goes with it. But yeah, mediation, yep. I mean, there are things that happen. There is evidence, you can bring it, but it's not for me. Like, I can't do anything about it. It's more about how can the past inform and help guide the future? You know, so if this happened in the past, what agreements need to be in place, or what discussions need to be had to prevent that repeat situation?
Yeah, fair enough.
It is now a compulsory part of family court. So, I mean, unless where it comes under an exception or is an emergency, then you would have to see a mediator before you can go to court.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. I had a few friends of mine over the, like two or three of them had to go through mediation and sort of separate assets and talk about custody and all that stuff. And yeah, it sounds like it has the potential to get nasty. So good on you for having a level head through that, because I imagine people would get quite heated during these debates and discussions. So
yeah, it can, I guess. And that's also where my role is, to guide the process so that I'm not, you know, to reduce the risk of exposing someone to that kind of outburst or you know, having an outburst. I mean, I can't control everything, but I guess that's part of my role, to have a break before things escalate. Or if things can escalate quickly, then let's have a break and see what needs to be done to prevent that. But sometimes you need that natural kind of escalation or impasse to then get over that. So that's what I find as well.
Yeah, fair enough. That makes sense to me. So, okay, you've been practicing this for a long time, and amongst your skill set, you're also a published author. And we'll talk about your book, It's Not You, It's Me. It's been described as a robust tool for self-reflection, grounded in strength-based approach. And this tool serves as a guiding mechanism, shedding light on the factors that differentiate those who succumb to personal crisis from those who triumph over them. So, and it talks about like overthinking. So I guess before I get you to talk to me about your book, can you just talk to us about like what is overthinking and sort of what is the process of it, and what are some tools people might be able to use to combat it?
Sure. Now, overthinking, what I have concluded is an analysis of a situation, right? But that analysis of a situation focuses on what's wrong, you know, the weakness, what could go wrong or what has gone wrong in the past. But if you look at the opposite, because I like to sort of think in opposites because we have what's actually happening and then the opposite of what's happening, where that provides opportunity for us to learn and you know, to reflect on ourselves. So the opposite then of overthinking is self-reflection. And then self-reflection is an analysis of a situation, but that analysis focuses on what's strong, you know, the strengths, the potential learning opportunities and with a future focus. So that's really my overthinking 101 sort of very quick and simple definition. So essentially, if you can overthink, you can self-reflect. It's more about the quality of the thoughts in play.
Okay, well, that's interesting. But you're right, though. Now think about it. If you can overthink, you can reflect because you're a thinker. Like you analyze and you break things down. I suppose, yeah, it's like if you are an overthinker, it's kind of analytical, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm definitely an overthinker. There are times where I think I'm guilty for something when I'm not even remotely involved, or I start to break things down going, oh, shit, what have I done here? Or I don't know. Like I think a few of my friends are the same. It's possibly human, like common for humans to think that. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert in the field, but it's interesting you say that. Now, let's talk about your book. How did you come about the process of writing it, and what was your inspiration to put it out, and what's it about exactly in your own words, please?
Yeah, well, essentially, it's really about my observations as a mediator on how people manage personal adversity. And then I sort of bring forward the trends that I noticed where I categorize all thoughts, feelings, and actions under what's wrong or what's strong, you know, as the two options. And then I go on to offer a strengths-based tool for self-reflection, you know, to help that analysis. And I use opposites a lot. So if we're in what's wrong mode, then we're more likely to be judgmental. We're more likely to show criticism. And we're more likely also to be making assumptions. Whereas if we're in self-reflection, we're more likely to be in what's strong mode, which is the opposite of what's wrong. And we're more likely to be in understanding mode, which is the opposite of judgment, or respect mode, again, which I propose is the opposite of criticism, and then also have more of a future focus, which then again, opposite of having staying in past situations.
So yeah, that's okay. So you can helps you like identify what's going on in yourself and teach your own, and then it gives you tools, gives the reader tools to sort of reflect.
Yes.
And how to sort of.
There's just over 30 self-reflection tasks that are aimed at building on the concepts that are shared, you know, one at a time. And it's, you know, it's self-paced. So, you know, you can go through and do the exercises that are relevant to your situation.
Yep. And can you tell us about the writing process? What's some of the challenge you had to overcome during the process?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, I am self-publishing. I have self-published. Initially I wrote a story about an overthinker, and it was her life and the challenges that she had. And the last chapter of that book was a self-help chapter based on the character's challenges. And as part of my publishing journey, I was told that I couldn't have fiction and nonfiction in one book. So I rewrote the entire book based on the last chapter, which was, you know, the self-help chapter. And so as a self-publisher, it didn't start like that. I actually did have a publisher in 2020. I mean, that situation was, you know, was over by 2021, I guess, because we had different, I don't know, different, not different ideas, but I guess the publisher felt that my book wasn't in line with the books that she was publishing on a more of a spiritual sort of theme. But and I share this because at the time I really wanted to have a publisher, and looking back on it, it was also because I didn't believe in my book, so I needed someone else to believe in it. And then once I did have a publisher, then I could actually see my work through the what's strong lens, whereas I had previously looked at it through what's wrong, you know, that I'm a no one, this is my first book, I don't know what I'm writing, and my grammar's terrible, you know, all these sort of things. But then once she had a look at it, and she actually said to me, you know, I have a teenage daughter who's very anxious, and she really benefited from the concepts in your book. And that sort of meant, oh, okay, this is it might be able to help, you know, it might be useful. And she also suggested that I run workshops in high schools. And so even though that commercial relationship ended, I've left with this great idea to run workshops in schools, and also the confidence to say, oh, actually, there is value in what I've written. And it gave me the confidence to then go out and do it on my own and actually run workshops in high schools. So I guess it's quite interesting how I wrote a book that looks at what's wrong and what's strong as, you know, options that guide our life. But the whole publishing process from my approach really focused on what was wrong with my own situation. So that now as a self-publisher, it's been quite a learning journey. And I've been lucky enough to actually be able to connect with professionals who can help and guide me, you know, help me even, you know, with whether it is editing or design, because you need to have all these different elements in the book. And now in terms of marketing and publicity, then I've also been able to connect with, you know, really amazing people who've been able to help me. One of them's actually been on your podcast.
Nicole, I was about to say I should connect you with Nicole. She was really nice to talk to yesterday.
Yeah, yes. So, yeah, she's helping me get my book out there as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's come full circle.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think, and another thing that I'd say to anyone who's looking to publish, that the Australian Society of Authors is a really excellent resource. And it's a paid membership. I mean, you can access their website and their information if you don't pay. But once you do pay, then you get a lot more services. You get directories. I guess that's how I found Nicole, because I looked on that, you know, who can help, you know, with the marketing and publicity, and Nicole was suggested. But even if you're looking for a designer, or if you're looking for even advice, like legal advice, or if you've got a contract with a publisher and you need help. So anyone out there publishing, the Australian Society of Authors is really worth the membership. And they often also have events as well, so that you can, they have like speed dating, but it's all, I mean, literally, you know, in terms of writing and publishing, so that you can pitch your work, you know, either to an agent or if you need, you know, help with your submission. So just going to plug that association, because it's helped me a lot.
No, that's good. I'll chuck a link in the bio as well. That's a good shout out.
Yeah. Cool.
You spoke about doing workshops. You actually sort of half answered my next question, but you did workshops with high schools and professional ones, I see. Just in terms of like a high school workshop you might do, what are some of the things that you would cover in one of said workshops?
Yeah. So, I mean, the basis is really about providing high school students with the tools to reflect, and, you know, using that what's wrong and what's strong as a basis. But then I really build on that and look at how, you know, our self-esteem is impacted, and relationships that we have can also build on that, because, you know, I see self-esteem as a reflection of how much we believe in ourselves. So, and that's always moving, because there are some parts of our life where our self-esteem is a lot stronger, you know, because we believe in our ability in that part of our life. But then there are other times or other areas in our lives where, you know, our self-esteem isn't that strong, that solid, and it's because we believe in ourselves less in there. And so I guess how much we believe in ourselves is then a reflection of the interactions of the, sorry, it's a reflection of the quality of the interactions we have with ourselves. And it's, you know, do our interactions with ourselves focus on what's wrong or what's strong? And also the quality of interactions with others. Do they focus on what's wrong or what's strong? And essentially, I propose that all interactions with ourselves or with others that focus on what's strong build on our sense of self and how much we believe in ourselves. And that the opposite is that all interactions with ourselves or with others that focus on what's wrong then take away from our sense of self. So, and I mean, you know, it could also include, we started the conversation talking about social media, but, you know, interactions with others could also include our interactions with social media. Does that focus on what's wrong or what's strong? And I think that's can be a challenge, not just for teenagers, but just, you know, for anyone generally, you know, and also looking at relationships and friendships where some are healthy and not so healthy, they can be broken down into what's wrong or what's strong. So I guess I really believe in this, the power of this way of categorizing our thoughts, feelings, and actions, and that it can have a really deep impact once we learn how to apply it, and that applying it is really reflecting on it rather than being in what's strong the whole time, because that's, you know, virtually impossible. It's more about how we are able to then reflect and say, okay, I was going down the what's wrong path then. What have I learned from that? Or even just sit with, that's what I did, and just have that awareness is fine. And I guess what happens is the time frame or our ability to have that reflection, then it becomes quicker or smoother. I guess time doesn't matter, but it just becomes smoother, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and you're right, like chasing that high, chasing that good feeling all the time will ultimately lead you down a negative path, because if you're constantly chasing the high, I mean, it's similar to that of an addict of something, you know, like if someone's chasing the high of loving, I don't know, a job they might have and they suddenly get redundant, or if they are chasing a narcotic or something, like it's not feasible. Like it's not feasible to feel good all the time. And if you can teach strength, teach resilience, teach reflection like you are, then I think as a person, we grow. And I'm going to be honest, I've suffered on and off over the years a bit of anxiety, and I've learned some techniques to help reflect. And if people are able to learn these from you as well, and then it's made me a better person. Like, for example, if you come up against a crisis of some sort, whether it's in the mediation field or whether it's just on a day-to-day life, and if you have the tools and if you have like the knowledge on how to deal with a complex scenario, you'll come through it better and you'll feel good.
Yeah.
And those highs will come. And that's why I do this, because I'm at my best when I'm doing this. And it's important to a friend of mine who was on the porch, he said, if you can feed the plant, water the plants that you want to see grow, whether it's professionally, personally, and if you know, less time spent on the negative, which is what you're doing, teaching the reflection, then the person who's going through that will have, you know, will be a better person, essentially. Like, I'm not a wordsmith, but I think that's pretty accurate, I think, is what you're achieving here.
Because, and when we're sort of moving away from self-reflection and going into overthinking, we beat ourselves up, you know, when instead of reflecting and learning, we beat ourselves up. We have regret and shame for what we have done or what we didn't do. Whereas if we can flip that, and even if we flip it after and say, okay, well, that's what's happened. What have I learned? You know, how can I use this for the future? Or even just about not being so hard on yourself. That's, even that is enough, you know. And I guess that's, you know, that going back about, it's not about positivity 100% of the time. And I guess that's something that irks me, that, you know, about these social media influencers. I know, sorry, I'm going back to it, but I find a lot of sort of these mental health influences are really pushing that positivity. And you've got to have this routine, and you get up in the morning and you meditate and you do this and you do that and you have your gratitude. And, you know, those things work and people do them. But I guess it's about, you know, when it's so prescriptive, then is it setting people up to fail when they can't keep it up or they can't be that positive all the time? Because, you know, bad things happen and we just have to, you know, I guess walk through it. And the more we are able to reflect, the more we believe in ourselves, the easier it is to walk through, because we're going to be more resilient. If we believe in ourselves, then when we are faced with challenges, then we'll be able to walk through. And even if there's people who don't believe in ourselves, who don't believe in us, and they show us that, if we do, then it doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, and I guess I go back to my publishing, you know, situation where a publisher wanted to take me on that showed me the strength in my work. And it also gave me the confidence to say, actually, I want to do this on my own. I don't like the rules and the way that the publishing industry works. It's not for me. Then when that ended, like it could have been really, and maybe, you know, it could have been quite devastating. But I guess for me, I was able to, because essentially she said, I believe in you, I want to take you on, but now I don't believe in you and I don't want to take you on. That, I guess that's how it could have been interpreted, but it didn't matter because I believed in me. So whatever, I don't know what she was thinking, I can hypothesize, but it hadn't, you know, it didn't matter because I had already gone through that reflective process and thought, actually, this is something I really want to do. And I want to do it on my own.
Yeah, and you could send yourself crazy trying to think of what someone else is thinking, analyze and go, oh, I'm not good enough. But as you said, if you're backing yourself, no one can bring you down. It's like another guest, Kim, she's a dating expert, and she said it's similar in the dating field. If you're putting yourself out there, presenting your best self, and you like genuinely back yourself, believe in yourself, no one can bring you down. And that, you know, that radiance, that warmth is – it's like gravity. It draws you in, and, you know, why should you compromise your creative, you know, your project, your book, you know, this is something that you've created. Why should you change that just because someone doesn't back you? If you believe to your core that this is great, you know, and you might get offered some advice on here or there, but if you believe to your core it's what you're about, then no one has the right to bring you down. Like, that's why I do this. Like, I've had people say, oh, you delve into this. I'm like, well, you know what? It doesn't cost you a cent. Don't listen. It's that simple.
Yeah, that's right.
And yeah, like it's in many facets. But we need
strength to respond in that way.
Say that again, sorry.
We need strength to be able to respond in that way.
Yeah, agree. 100% agree.
Without us.
Yeah. And yeah, if you're out there listening and you're just driving in the car, you're at work or whatever it might be, and if there's something that you know you're good at, always back yourself. I mean, some of the most creative and talented individuals on the planet back themselves. A lot of people said no to them. I mean, look at, you know, if you're an NRL fan, Jonathan Thurston, who's gone on to be one of the greatest players of all time.
Yeah.
And they said to him at the Bulldogs, you're too small. No one will give you a first grade start. And look at it. He's absolutely had one of the greatest careers of all time. You look at Kevin Smith, the director, he maxed out credit cards. He filmed it in black and white to save money, and he's been directing and been in mainstream pop culture for 30-odd years because he backed himself. Like it's,
and there's so many stories like that. Like even J.K. Rowling, who wrote Harry Potter, she got rejected. So I think it was 12 times before she actually got published.
Well, that's, yeah, exactly right. And the best stories come from those that back themselves. So, you know.
Yeah, so there's a lot to be said for leaning into our strengths and even reflecting on the times when we don't.
That's true. That's very true. Now, if people wanted to get a copy of your book or possibly get in touch with you, where can they find yourself and how would they go about getting in touch?
The best place to go is to my website, rosemarygattuso.com. And then I've got, you know, links to all my socials there as well. I mean, it's all just Rosemary Gattuso. And there you can, you know, buy the book or connect with me, you know, on my contact page or via social media. Even though I did bitch about social media, it is still a really nice way of connecting.
Well, we could take your approach and go, we could overthink it, or we could reflect and go, okay, that's only a small part of it, but there are so many benefits to social media. So yeah, you can, I use it to send memes and tell people when an episode comes out. So for every from the vibe I'm getting, for every negative, there's a positive, and you can that's think right. about,
yeah,
you know, so yeah, no, that sort of comes full circle, and which will include a link to the website, plus I'll include a link to the, sorry, what you plugged before,
the Australian Society of Authors.
Yep, the place where aspiring authors can go to get advice and stuff. Sorry, I haven't had a mind blank then. But and for anyone who has been to one of your workshops, might have read your book, worked with you in mediation, is there anything that you'd like to say to those people who have backed you and supported you during your career so far?
Yes, I guess I'd say thank you for being so open and trusting me, you know, because a lot of times in mediation, people, you know, clients don't know who I am. They just, you know, see that I'm the mediator, and they open up and tell me, you know, what their fears are. And so that's really an honor to be able to sit in that process. And then, you know, look at, I guess, where I am now, where I've been able to draw out, you know, what I noticed from, you know, working with people going through adversity, and even through my own adversity, you know, and being able to present that in a book. So, you know, it wouldn't have been possible without, you know, all my clients and experiences over the years.
Yeah, nice. And you know, you're a current, you know, you're currently practicing this as well. So you've got, you know, you've had a decades of experience. So you definitely have credibility. You know what you're talking about. You relate to those people who do an everyday thing and overthinking and just trying to make it easier and better for you know, for the average Joe or Jane Doe like myself. And yeah, I'll be buying a copy of your book. I'm interested to learn some more tools on how to reflect, and I'm looking forward to trying to better myself as well, which we can always, humans can always improve. So if you're out there and you find yourself in a similar boat to me, just yeah, take some time, reflect, maybe check out Rosemary's website, and if you know, find another tool there and help yourself, because I think the most resilient people out there are self-helpers. Like, there are those who are happy, like, will need to rely on other people, but if you're a little bit self-reliant, self-sufficient, you can have a better day-to-day life. That's what I found. I live by myself. I have for a while, and going through life, you know, by yourself has its pros and cons. Like, it'd be nice to meet someone, I'll be honest, but going through life, and you know, I navigated living in Europe by myself too. And I felt so accomplished when I come home. My confidence skyrocketed. I was able to live a life by myself on the other side of the planet, you know, make things happen. And here in Orange as well, I've got a few friends I made through work, but the support network I have is mostly Newcastle. So it teaches you resilience. And talking about that classic overthinking, self-reflection approach, it's leaps and bounds compared to the person I used to be. So I genuinely wanted to say thank you for aiding people, not only personally but professionally as well. I can tell that you're full of empathy and compassion, and it comes through in your words. And you are doing really well. And I look forward to reading your book, and I look forward to collaborating with you in the future. And maybe we can have another episode going forward, and we'll talk about some more specific scenarios that you might go over through your mediation and stuff if you're up for it. And we'll revisit this in a little while. How's that sound?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks, Mitch.
No worries. And thank you for coming on today. It's been an interesting chat. I haven't really shared a story of someone with your background, like in mediation and tackling the overthinking. And it's quite a unique sort of setup here, because you've, one, you're, you know, you studied at Harvard, which I think is incredibly cool. You talk about you know, aiding in the development of children and families, and you're doing workshops, helping, you know, workplaces and schools, and you're an author and you're going from strength to strength. So yeah, I power to you. I think it's great.
Thank you. And, I think it's also because I am an overthinker, I sort of and do a lot of analyzing and observing and take things in. So this is the result.
And yeah, and keep going forward. Please keep doing what you're doing. You're making the world a better place. And,
thanks.
No worries. And as I said, once again, all the links will be posted in the bio. Is there anything you'd like to close out on, Rosemary?
Oh, no, it's just been lovely chatting and great to, you know, talk about a variety of topics that are all really meaningful and important to me.
No, that's good. This is your story, and I love having people like yourself on. And if you're still listening, which I know you would be, thank you all, and I appreciate it. And go check out Rosemary's website, give her a shout, and we'll go from there. So as always, thanks all for listening, and I'll see you on the next one. Bye for now.